It's a privilege to be able to talk to you about William Carey. I always love it when people ask me to talk about William Carey. Most of the people that know me well don't want me to talk about William Carey anymore. I'm a big William Carey nerd. We were just over in London, and I found out we're helping start a church in London, and there's a guy from our church in Argentina who's over there, and love him dearly. But found out that he was telling people, don't ask Sam questions about William Carey, because if you ask Sam questions about William Carey, he never stops. So somebody told me this, so I had a good talk with Esteban about that. Been studying William Carey for a long time, did my master's thesis on it, and now I'm working on a PhD at Southern, and that's going to be my area of research. William Carey... of course, he's the father of modern missions. That's where I want to go. The father of modern missions. And if you start reading the literature about William Carey, you'll run into people who say that he's really not the father of modern missions. And the reason they'll say that he's not the father of modern missions is they'll say, well, there were other missionaries before him. Well, that's an obvious thing. Of course, there were other missionaries before him. But the key is that he is the father of modern missions. And there's an important distinction to be made between what happened from William Carey on and what happened from William Carey in back. Now, William Carey, he's famous for a number of things. He wrote, before he ever went to the mission field, he wrote a book, or a tract, really, a pamphlet called The Inquiry. And I can never remember the whole name. It's an inquiry into the use of means for... I can't remember. It's something about reaching... it's one of those long titles, and if you read the whole title, basically you have the argument of the whole book. And so it's almost an outline of what he's going to say in the book. And that book was a key book for... it is really what launches the modern missionary movement. And in that book, in The Inquiry, he talks about the fact that this... He understands that this is not a new idea. Now, in The Inquiry, he talks about reasons why we should be involved in missions. He recovers the Great Commission, because up till that time, people had the idea that the Great Commission was really only for the apostles. It wasn't for people afterwards. In fact, some of the reformers had that idea. Calvin, when he writes about the Great Commission, doesn't see it as something that's incumbent upon the church in his day. Which doesn't mean that Calvin didn't have a missionary heart, or that they weren't involved in evangelism, that they weren't involved in church planting. In fact, they sent missionaries to Brazil. So there was a lot of missions going on. Then the Puritans were involved in missionary efforts. They were involved in missions in evangelistic efforts in the United Kingdom and England at that time. They printed lots of books. They were very active in trying to reach people and basically in turning England to the cause of Christ. And then we know about the great missions efforts that they made in what would be the American colonies at that time. We've heard of David Brainerd, where there were missionaries before that who made large efforts to reach out to the Indians, the North Americans, the Native Americans. And so we know that there was missions going on before that time. And, of course, before William Carey, we have the Moravians. He was greatly influenced by the Moravians. But up until the time of William Carey, if you were to ask somebody, you know, the Great Commission, is that for us? They would have said, Protestants in general would have said, no, that was for the apostles. It was something for specifically given to the apostles. And the reason for that way of thinking was that they had been involved, the Protestants had been involved in a long fight with the Catholic Church, and they were concerned about the Catholic Church and the Pope assuming the apostolic role, the idea of apostolic succession. And so there, when they came to that, they were doing everything they could to take away any ammunition that the Catholic Church might have to say there's a continuity, there's the apostolic office continues. And so their tendency was to say this was just for the apostles, and when the apostles died, the apostolic office died, and so anything to the apostles also was over at that time. Well, he looked at the Great Commission, and he saw things that looked to us, you know, now it seems perfectly obvious, but at that time there were kind of new ideas. He said, well, look at the Great Commission. There's a couple things in there that if you're going to throw the Great Commission out and say this is only for the apostles, that leaves us in a strange place. He says, for example, it's in the Great Commission that we have the commandment to baptize. So is that something that was only incumbent on the apostles? Well, obviously, we're not going to go there. And he says, how about the promise at the end of the Great Commission? At the end of the Great Commission is the promise that he would be with us every day until the end of the age. So is that over? Is that promise no longer valid? And he said, of course not. And there was another argument that had to do with eschatology at that time, and the idea that it would come back into play again when the two witnesses were revealed. And it was kind of, I never have quite understood that argument, but he kind of blows it away. So he had those three main points, and so he recovers the Great Commission. So when you hear someone say, you know, William Carey really isn't the father of modern missions, and I've heard a couple of Baptist scholars, actually, people that I kind of respect, but who I disagree with on that, when they say, you know, he was a great missionary, but he's not, it's really wrong to call him the father of modern missions. I say one reason we call him the father of modern missions is he recovered the Great Commission. Now, we think of the Great Commission as being something just obvious, that we should obey it. Well, that comes from William Carey and the inquiry. And William Carey is also, I think, the rightly called the father of modern missions, because he struggled with the idea of how do we go about getting missions accomplished? How do we go about it? And it's still a big question about what's the best way to do missions. And yesterday we were sitting around the table and we were talking about some of the issues that come up as Baptist churches go about trying to do missions. And I'm not sure we have yet found the perfect answer for how you do that. If you believe in Baptist churches, if you believe that a Baptist church is there's no greater authority, there's no presbytery over the church. Each local church is independent and self-sufficient, it contains its own authority. Then how do you go about doing world mission? So let's say, you know, the church here in Clarksville, you know, it's one thing. OK, let's say there's a town near here that needs a church and you have people willing to go. So you can go and do that. You go to preach and God, you know, you eventually plant a church. That makes perfect sense. But what if you want to go to China? Can you do that? Well, you can send your pastor over there and he can go some, but he can't be pastor here and there as well. And so then if you start looking at the needs of the whole world and you want to be involved in Latin America and you'd like to see fruit in India and you feel God calling you to be involved in Africa, how does this church, this particular local congregation in Clarksville, how do they get involved in world mission? And that's a big question. And so as a Baptist church, it becomes a complicated issue. Well, it's one that William Carey wrestled with. And if you think about the history of mission, you know, Catholic missions had been going on for a number of years, hundreds of years, before William Carey wrote the inquiry, and they launched what became the Baptist Missionary Society. And Catholic missions, they had an answer. How do you do missions? Well, they had a number of agencies that could go out and do missions. They had the different religious orders. And before that, you go back, a lot of missions was driven by the monastic movement. For example, the growth of the gospel way back, for example, in Ireland was driven by monasteries. And you could look at that and there's things that you'd go, I'm not sure all of that was exactly right. And you'd be right about that. But Christianity moved forward because, first of all, the monasteries, and then later on, in later Catholic history or church history, you have religious orders like the Jesuits. The Jesuits did a very effective job of spreading, of carrying the Catholic Church to Latin America, to Japan, as far away as Japan. The Jesuits were active in India. They were very active in China. So they had monastic, the Franciscans and the Dominicans and these other religious orders provided a method, a way of getting organized and going about doing the job of mission. And those of you guys, I was talking yesterday to someone who's involved in, I forget your name, but you're involved in logistics. So the whole issue of logistics is how do you get something done? You have a mission. How do you get from point A to point B? How do you get supplies there? How do you organize your soldiers in a way that you're going to be effective in? And so the Army has its answers. The Marine Corps have their, but it all involves some sort of planning and organizational planning. And so what William Carey did was, he says, should we use means? That's the argument. Should we use means for the evangelization of the heathen? And when he talked about means, he was thinking about just methods and organization and tools that might be available. And so that was really the launch, the beginning of modern missions. This whole process of beginning to think through, here we have local churches, and then we see the great needs of the world, and we have a great commission that drives us. How do we work through this process of actually going about the job of missions? And his answer, and I'm not saying that necessarily his answer is the best answer, because if you study the history of it, there's problems with the answer he gives. But his answer was, let's form a missionary society. And I think his reasoning process is the right one, and it's one that we should apply nowadays. And we're going to get into that in a few minutes, but I want to work through a couple of other things and then come back to the idea of how he arrived at the idea of a missionary society. I've got some quotes that I'd like to share with you. First of all, there's a quote from an Indian scholar who talks about William Carey and his importance. He says, this is S.D. Alagadi. He said, in the modern history of Christianity, two great men of God, Martin Luther and William Carey, have played a very significant role in ushering in two different eras in the history of the Christian church. And I think what this Indian scholar says is exactly right, and is probably more profound than maybe we realize when we first hear it. What he's saying, he says, we really need to put two men kind of at the very top, key figures in the history of maybe the last 500 years of Christianity. One is Martin Luther, and Martin Luther is famous for what? What did Martin Luther do? I got an answer on the front row. Let's hear one from a little further back. Martin Luther is important for what thing in history?
95 theses.
95 theses, but what did that lead to?
Reformation.
The Reformation. So in a sense, Martin Luther is the father of the Reformation. Could we call him that? Well, some people would, if you want to start, you know, really getting picky, there were important figures before Martin Luther. There were people in different places, in England, in Huss, in different places, who were important figures before Martin Luther ever came along. And there were other men who were already moving in this direction. But it was Martin Luther who, when he nailed the 95 theses on the Wittenberg door, that he launched the Reformation. So he's not the only figure, but he is legitimately the person who we say that's where the Reformation begins. And when Alagadi says, it puts William Carey on the same level. First of all, I think it's a good analogy to understand why we would say that William Carey is the father of modern missions, and at the same time recognize that there were people who came before him. Just like there are forerunners to the Reformation, there are forerunners to the modern missionary movement, but William Carey is the father of the modern missionary movement. And it's also important because it gives us a sense of great movements in history. When the Reformation comes along, there's this tremendous movement of God in world history that impacts everything. Of course, the preaching of the gospel. It impacts government. It impacts culture. But if you think about it, the impact of the Reformation was limited mostly to Europe and the American colonies. So from the time of the Reformation up until the time of William Carey, the impact of the Reformation by that time is really limited not just to Europe as a whole, but only to Northern Europe, because there's been in Southern Europe the Counter-Reformation. Of course, the Counter-Reformation is a product of the Reformation, but it's a negative influence or a counter-influence of the Reformation. So the Reformation per se is only holds sway in Northern Europe and in the British Isles. And because it's a British colony, in the American colonies, by the time, you know, this is, Carey goes to India in 1792, and so by this time, of course, the United States is now an independent country, but the Reformation is limited to what used to be the American colonies, the United States, and Northern Europe. Okay, so what happens when William Carey goes to India? Well, with William Carey going to India, you have the dawn of the great century of missionary expansion, of Protestant missionary expansion. Before this, there's a handful of missionaries. The Danes had actually put some missionaries in India. The Moravians had put some, there had some efforts in India. The Moravians had done some good things in different parts of the world, but there was, we don't see an explosion of missionary activity until William Carey's efforts catch fire. And when he goes to India, all of a sudden there's an explosion of missionary activity. Not only does the Baptist Missionary Society begin to send missionaries, but very soon after, I don't remember the dates, but before the turn of the century, so this is 1792, before 1800, the Congregationalists and the Anglicans have formed missionary societies. There's missionary societies that are formed in Scotland, and all of a sudden there's hundreds of missionaries going to all the different points of the world. And so there's a huge, in missions history, the 19th century, from 1800 to 1900, is called the Great Century of Missionary Expansion. And it literally is an explosion of missionary activity. And now you can read books that talk about, you know, when we read, when we watch the news, you might have the idea that the biggest, fastest growing religion in the world is Islam. Well, it certainly is a rapidly growing religion. But the largest religion, the religion that has the most influence around the world is not Islam. It's Christianity. When you hear, for example, about what is happening with the church in China, that's the result of the 19th century explosion of missionary activity that bore fruit. And now there's a strong influence. And you hear all kinds of different figures. I've heard 80 million. I've heard higher numbers. What would you put as the number of Christians in China? There's no way to know. But it's just, it's huge. Now, not what we'd like it to be. There's still huge needs. But everywhere you go, you see the influence of Christianity. There's so much work left to be done. But Protestant Christianity that used to be limited just to Northern Europe and to the Americas now had become, or to be just the, you know, the East Coast of the United States, really, now is a world religion. In fact, there are places in the world where, you know, we see it dying out. We were, like I said, we were recently in England, and you see Christianity to a degree beginning to die out in Northern Europe. But it's vital. There's a vital expression of Christianity in many places around the world. And so, who's the most important? Luther, who begins the Reformation, or William Carey, who is that point at which Protestant Christianity explodes and expands around the world? Now, I understand when you look at a lot of the different manifestations of that Protestant Christianity, there's all kinds of stuff. But all that says is that there's still a lot to work of work to be done. But it really is, I think, appropriate to put William Carey and Martin Luther on the same scale. I would say the two most important figures in the last 500 years of Christian history. So William Carey, we've always talked about William Carey. Our seminary is named after William Carey. Part of the reason is we wanted our students to have a missionary vision. And William Carey, I think, is a great example for students coming out of Latin America. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Part of that is his character, and part of that is where he comes from. He came from a very poor background. He was born in 1761. His dad was a weaver. He was also a school teacher, and we've been to the place where he was born. It's a little town. My wife and I have been twice. A little town called Pollersbury. It's in northern England, or kind of in the Midlands of England, close to Northampton. And it is not a town. It's a very quaint little town, but it's not where you would think that this important historical figure might come from. And enjoy visiting the church. There's a church there that his dad was the church. He was the parish clerk. And so, which meant that he was kind of the uh, most important figure there. They didn't have an Anglican priest in that village. And so William Carey's dad was the clerk, and so he would have preached on occasion. William Carey himself talks about his boyhood. He wasn't a very necessarily obedient kid. And when you go there, I don't know if this can be documented historically, but you go into, you go visit the church. It's called St. James the Great. It's a typical English parish church. If you've ever been over there or seen pictures, if you've ever seen, my wife and I like to watch English detective stories on television, you know, like Agatha Christie, those kind of things. And they always have the parish church, but it's just like all those things that you see on television. Beautiful old church, and it's got the graveyard out front. They take you, they like to show you that right by the front door is the gravestone of Edmund Carey, who was William Carey's dad. And then they take you inside, and there's the pulpit where Edmund Carey would have preached from. And then right down, it would be like the third pew, then there's a big pillar right there on one side. And the both times that we've been there, the person who showed us was this wonderful old lady named Molly, who's almost 90 years old. And she would say, now this is where William always sat because his dad, because he was disobedient, and his dad liked to be able to have him close at hand so he could call his attention if he wasn't behaving properly. And so when I think about William Carey, I think he's a wonderful example because of where he comes from. He was poor. He was just an average boy. And the obstacles he had to overcome to become the missionary that he did become were, it seemed, we must have seemed at the time, insurmountable. And you need to read his biography about how he came to faith in Christ. God did a wonderful work in him. And he as he became a Christian, he was in an area where there was something of a revival going on. When you look at Baptist churches in England, there were separate areas. There were the London Baptist churches that were the most influential, but there were different associations, and there was an association around the city of Northampton. So the Northamptonshire Baptist Association. When he begins to move towards ministry, when he's in his first years of inquiring, trying to figure doctrinal issues out, he's in an area of England where there's something of a Baptist revival happening. And it's really, interestingly enough, it's the result of revivals that had happened years before in other circles. If you know anything about Christian history, if you know about the Great Awakening, if you know about Jonathan Edwards, what happens with the Northamptonshire Baptist is really kind of an echo of the Great Awakening that had happened 50 years before that time. The Northamptonshire Baptist, actually Baptist churches all over England were kind of dying. They were shriveling up and they were kind of blowing away with the wind. And in the process of a new generation of pastors was raised up in the area of Northamptonshire. A number of names, if you've studied Baptist history, John Ryland, Andrew Fuller. Last year you studied Samuel Pierce, who wasn't exactly from Northamptonshire, but was good friends with all these guys from Northamptonshire and definitely a part of this movement. Well, it was a group of younger Baptist pastors who were going, how come our churches are dying? And they were struggling with what's wrong with our churches. How come they're, you know, why are they declining so terribly? And the things they struggled with, they began to realize that the line of thinking that had been so influential in their among the churches was hyper-Calvinism. And they'd been influenced by a guy named Brine, by John Gill, who some people debate whether he was truly a hyper-Calvinist or not. But basically what many people were teaching at that time was that because God is sovereign and only God can save people, which we would agree with, what that implied, the implication of that was twofold. On the one hand, because God is sovereign, the minister is not responsible. In fact, not only is he not responsible to offer the gospel, he shouldn't offer the gospel. because that's meddling in things that only belong to God. And in addition, the unconverted person has no responsibility to listen to the gospel. Since he can only be saved by a sovereign act of God, how can he be responsible to hear the gospel and respond to the gospel? And so, well, if you think about that, what's that going to produce? It's going to produce, inevitably, dying churches. And so a new generation of Baptist leaders begins to struggle with this. And they find many answers in reading Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards had a huge influence on William Carey. He had an influence on William Carey, number one, because of he read a book that Jonathan Edwards had put together. It was the Journal of David Brainerd, who had been a missionary. And the example of David Brainerd just became a very huge influence in Carey's life. Then a number of these younger pastors reading Jonathan Edwards, they came across, and in fact, they republished a book that had been published by Jonathan Edwards years before. It was called A Call to Prayer. And so they republished John Sutcliffe, who was pastor of the Baptist Church in Olney, and a good friend of John Newton, by the way. They republished A Call to Prayer, and they began to pray. And I think it was something like 8 years before they actually sent William Carey to the mission field, they began to meet on a monthly basis and pray that God would revive his work and that God's cause would be extended. And essentially they were praying for world mission, even though I'm not sure they entirely understood what they were praying for. And years later, William Carey would say, really, our prayer efforts were very, very meager. He said they were almost embarrassing how meager our efforts really were, especially in comparison with the way God responded. God responded out of all proportion with our meager prayer efforts. And that's always been encouraging to me, because I'm not very as faithful as I should be in prayer. And yet I see God answer my prayers time after time. And I always have that same reaction. You know, I hardly prayed about this at all. And yet God is answering in a way that's beyond what I was anticipating. And that's what they discovered, is that God often answers. You know, our prayers don't force God to do anything. And God is sovereign and God does his work, but he wants us to first engage him in prayer. And so they prayed, and then they began to work through theological issues. And they came partly with help from Jonathan Edwards, but I think more importantly, by just going to the scriptures. There was an older pastor, a guy named Robert Hall, who wrote a book called Help for Zion's Weary Travelers. And it's just a wonderful pastoral book. And it deals with a lot of the issues that new believers or people who desired to come to Christ at that time, things that they were struggling with. And it was just a very encouraging book that if you feel conviction of sin, you shouldn't doubt that you can come to the cross. Salvation is available. Reconciliation is available. God will forgive you of your sins. And it was this book that was a great encouragement. It dealt with a number of things that were, it's a very Calvinistic book, and yet it's a very pastoral book, and it is not a hyper-Calvinistic book. And this book was a great influence on Fuller, on Carey, and on that generation. In fact, one of the things we did in London was go to, we actually went over to Bristol. The oldest Baptist college in the world is Bristol Baptist College. And they have Carey's original copy of Zion's Travelers. And it was really interesting to go through it. And he's got it all marked up. And so in all the margins, he's got places where you can see he's following Robert Hall's argument very closely and making notes in the margin. And it was a book that had a deep impact on Carey and was used by God to bring him to salvation. So he and then Andrew Fuller Andrew Fuller wrote a book called The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation. And this book was also a very critical book. And he just made the counter argument where some people were saying the sinner has no responsibility. He said, yes. The gospel is actually a commandment. You're commanded to believe. And so you do have a responsibility to believe. And should the pastor offer it, and they just went through Scripture and showed in the book of Acts how time after time the apostles offered the gospel, the free offer of the gospel. And then through all of Scripture, how the offer is there. And so his thing was that as it's not only do we have a right, but we have a responsibility as pastors to offer the gospel. Well, what's the result of that? This new generation of pastors begin to preach the gospel with clarity. People are drawn to Christ, drawn to the cross. People are converted. The churches begin to grow. They begin to have a great burden for towns around them that had no gospel witness. And so on Sundays, they would preach in their own churches, and then they would do what they called village preaching. They would go to the next village. How long do I have? Till 10:30, right? Okay, so they would go to the next village looking for places where the gospel hasn't been preached. And so all of a sudden this trend of dying churches and the churches disappearing, it's reversed. And there is an actual revival in Northamptonshire that begins to spread to the rest of the country. Well, the modern missionary movement comes out of this revival. And I think Carey just makes a few logical steps. He begins to think, if we have the responsibility to take the gospel, to preach the gospel from our own pulpit, and if we have the responsibility to preach the gospel to the people in the next town who don't have a gospel witness, don't we have a responsibility to take it to the heathen who have never heard? And it's hard to avoid that logic. It's hard to get around that. At some point, you have to say, yes, we do have that responsibility, especially when it's explicitly stated in the Great Commission. And so he began to kind of struggle with this idea. Is the Great Commission for us or not? And he comes to the conclusion, yes, it is. And so he writes the Inquiry. And the Inquiry, I think, is one of the most important documents in the history of the church. You can find different places and download the Inquiry. Has anybody ever read the Inquiry? Let me encourage you to find it. Maybe I can find, this afternoon I'll try to find a link that we could share. Because it's only like 90 pages. It's not that long. It's kind of an old-fashioned English, but it's not too hard to get through it. And to me, it's just every time I read it, it just stirs my heart. It's a very interesting document because it's a combination of a little bit of theological, scriptural argument, but then a little bit of church history. He goes through all the different efforts because what he's trying to say is, if these guys did it, why can't we? And then he kind of looks at the current situation. And his argument boils down to this. He says, first of all, do we have a command? Yeah, we do. So if we have a command, then the question is, do we have the means to obey the command? Because he says, if we don't have the means, then we're not responsible. He said, for example, Paul was responsible to obey the command as far as he could go. So when Paul goes, first of all, to Asia Minor, and then when Paul goes to Greece, to Macedonia and Athens, and then when he goes further and goes to Rome, and then he was wanting to go even further. He wanted to go to Spain. Well, that's just Paul going as far as he can possibly go, following the command that Christ had left his disciples. So he says, on the other hand, he wasn't responsible to go to, he says, Otaheite, which is an old-fashioned word that basically means the Pacific Islands, the South Sea Islands. And he had at that time, he was fascinated by just after the voyages of Captain Cook. Captain Cook had sailed around the world, and all these crazy stories of the South Sea Islands had come back, and everybody was fascinated with the South Sea Islands. Well, when William Carey reads those things, what he's seeing them is he's reading them with gospel lenses, and he's thinking about the needs of those people. And so he's drawn to go there. In fact, he wanted to go there as a missionary, and through a series of providential things, he ends up in India instead, which was really good. God knew what he was doing. But he was drawn to the South Sea Islands. So he says, Paul, in the Inquiry, he says he was not compelled to go to the South Sea Islands because he didn't know they existed. And if he did know they existed, there was no way at that time for him to get there. But he says, look at us. We do know they exist, and guess what? We have the means for going there. And so there's this, he goes through this kind of line of reasoning. He says, the command plus means equals obligation. If we can do it, we've got to do it. And he says, if you think about it, he says, people from our country go all over the world for the purposes of trade. They can get, you can get on a ship and you can travel to India. You can travel to the South Sea Islands. You can go almost anywhere in the world. And he said, people do that for the simple motive of just making a profit. He said, shouldn't we do the same thing for to reach and to win the souls of men? And I think it's a very compelling argument and one that's absolutely valid for us today. If we have a command and we have the means to obey the command, then we've got to obey. We're under obligation. And when people talk about missions, you know, they talk about the whole issue of missions motivations. Why do we do it? And if there are certain scholars who have looked back at the history of the church, and basically in the history of the church, you can find three different motivations. And they're all legitimate in their place. One that's very common today, John Piper wrote a book about missions. And in that book, he talks, what's the name of that book? Let the Nations Be Glad. And in the Let the Nations Be Glad, he says the overarching motivation for missions is the glory of God. And I think that's true. I think MacArthur pretty much, Piper pretty much makes his case, does it very effectively. It's definitely the glory of God is a primary motivation for missions. But there's another motivation, which is compassion for our fellow men. Should that motivate us? Well, as Reformed people, maybe we're going, man, maybe we shouldn't feel that compassionate. But Carey makes a strong case that if we have any kind of Christian love at all, we should feel sorry for those who have never heard the light of the, never been around the light of the gospel, never heard the message of hope that there is in the gospel, and we should be motivated by compassion for our fellow men. And so interestingly enough, he doesn't deal a lot with the glory of God. Now I have, there's places where he does in some of his letters where you can see that he is motivated by the glory of God. Let me see if I can find it in my notes. For example, he writes to his letter to his sister Mary. He says, this is just before he goes, my heart is set upon your undertaking. I much desire to take Felix, this is his son, with me. But it seems God will strip me of all earthly comforts. I find satisfaction, however, in reflecting that I am prompted by a sense of duty and a desire to God's glory, and that I am in his hands. I have never wavered about the duty itself, but I feel much leaving my family and people. In a letter to John Williams, a friend of his, he describes, this is later on when he's already in India, he describes the resistance to the gospel among the Brahmins, and he writes this, public disputes with them, also in the streets and any place where we meet with them, and always in the hearing of the common people, have in some measure excited them to reflect, but at present it has been of no use except to make them try to avoid disputes with us and to excite a laugh against them amongst others who are not permitted to read for themselves. Then he goes, I have no doubt, but in the end, the God of all grace will exert his almighty power and vindicate his authority and establish the glory of his own name in this wretched country. Our labors may be only like those of pioneers to prepare the way, but truth will assuredly prevail, and this among the other kingdoms of the earth shall assuredly see the salvation of our God. In 1821, his son Jabez went to, as a missionary to another place, and he writes, I've got a long paragraph, but he says, I know the difficulties of first engaging in this work are great and feel much for you standing alone in that vast hell, but I am sure the Lord can give you strength according to your day, and he will sustain all who with a single eye to his glory engage in his glorious work. So we know that he was motivated by God's glory. But in the inquiry itself, he doesn't deal much with it. There's a couple of statements that are sort of elliptical that I think you could say the glory of God is behind those statements, but he doesn't really develop it. And what he develops is, number one, compassion for fellow man. And more importantly, he deals with the idea of duty, because he's trying to reestablish the Great Commission as a commandment that's incumbent upon us now. And you know, when MacArthur's... why am I confusing Piper with MacArthur? When Piper's book came out, I was thinking, this is all true, I think. And did, you know, does it in some ways supersede Carey's position, his approach to duty? Because over and over he talks about being motivated by duty. And Piper, in fact, in that book, if I remember right, says, you know, a kind of duty is a dry motivation. It just, you know, it really doesn't do us for us. We want to do it because of the glory of God. And but somehow, Carey didn't see it as a dry thing. I think it's the very core of what drove William Carey, the sense of duty. And as I've thought about it, this is my idea. I don't know if this is where Carey's coming from, but I think this might be where Carey's coming from. Absolutely. The big picture is the glory of God. But you know, you can talk about the glory of God, and that can be a little vague. Scripture tells us that we should do all things to the glory of God. And so we can go, I'm doing this to the glory of God, and I'm doing that to the glory of God, and it never gets very specific. Well, the Great Commission is very specific. This is the command we've been given. So it's good to talk about the glory of God, but Reformed Baptist, do we believe in the regulative principle? How do we glorify God? Well, God tells us how to glorify God. Does he not? Okay, so how does God tell us to glorify God? Well, that's where our duty comes in. Our duty is to glorify God by glorifying God as God has said, glorify me. And we are to glorify God by carrying the gospel to the nations, by preaching the whole counsel of Christ. It's in the Great Commission, and it's a commandment. In fact, I've started calling it an eschatological commandment. As Reformed Baptists, we believe in all 10 of the commandments. Am I right? Okay, there's an additional commandment. I'm not trying to put it as the 11th commandment. But it is an eschatological mandate. What are we to do during this time? This time between the times, between the ascension and the parousia, between Christ going and Christ returning. He's given us very specific instructions. This is how you're to glorify me. And it's all summed up in the Great Commission. So when Carey focuses in on duty, he's on to something. And something I think sometimes we're still missing. We have a very specific command. And his line of reasoning is very simple. We have a command. Do we have the means to obey the command? Yes, we do. So if we have the means to obey the command, then we're under obligation. We have got to go. I've heard someone say, you know, do we need a call when we have a command? And I think there's something to that. And that doesn't mean everybody's supposed to get up and go to the mission field tomorrow. But our churches must be missionary churches. That's what it's all about. Why are we concerned about correct doctrine? Why is the confession important to us? Because we believe it's a faithful expression of biblical doctrine. And this is part of our job of teaching them all things whatsoever I've commanded you. So we need to see the confession in the light of the commission. Does that make sense? And I think sometimes we can be so focused on the confession, and not to at all downplay the confession, but we don't see the confession in light of the commission. The confession is a tool for fulfilling the commission. And we have a duty, we have a commandment from God, and so we must obey. So he wrote the inquiry. That's kind of the main line of his thinking in it. There's statistics in it. It's really the birth of modern missiology. You read, how many have ever read looked at Patrick Johnson's, what's that book, where it's all this information, Operation World, an amazing book. There's all this information about world Christianity. You can trace that all back to William Carey and the Inquiry. Just like I said that I think William Carey needs to be put on the same level as Martin Luther, the Inquiry, I think needs to be held up as one of the greatest documents in the history of the modern era. It's kind of interesting. It occurs during the era, the a period of great manifestos. So the inquiry comes out in 1792, I think it is. Can you think of any other important documents from the last part of the 18th century? The Declaration of Independence. Yeah. There's another one by Paine, by Thomas Paine, called the Declaration of the Rights of Man. It's a period of great manifestos that have an impact on the way we live down to this day. And at some point it occurred to me, studying all this stuff in the background of all that, I realized this may, bigger than the Declaration of Independence, is Carey's Inquiry. And it's an old document, you know, but this still, it's a living document. And it's one that I think we would do well to read and absorb and apply in our own time period. Very simple equation. Do we have a command? Do we have the means to obey the command? So if we have the means to obey the command, then we're under obligation. We must do it without delay.
Thank you, brother.